Goldman Sachs issuing an asymmetric sell-off warning is not something to treat as routine market commentary. Goldman's research desk has been conservative in its public warnings, and when they flag asymmetric risk, meaning the downside is disproportionately larger than the upside, they're communicating something specific about probability distributions, not just general uncertainty. The confluence of factors they're pointing to includes geopolitical volatility from the Iran situation, Federal Reserve uncertainty on the rate path, and a market that is priced for relatively optimistic outcomes on both dimensions.
S&P futures are sitting at roughly 7,556 as we record this, off about 0.19% from the prior session. That's not dramatic movement, but it's happening in a context where multiple risk factors are live simultaneously. The Iran Strait of Hormuz situation alone creates potential for a significant energy price shock that would complicate the Fed's calculus on inflation and rates. If energy prices spike, that's inflationary pressure that pushes against rate cuts, which the market has been pricing in for the second half of 2026.
Fundstrat's Tom Lee, adding his voice to the bear market warning, specifically flagging conditions later in 2026, is notable because Lee has been consistently more bullish than consensus for much of the past few years. When someone with that track record of optimism starts raising caution flags, it signals a genuine shift in how sophisticated market observers are reading the risk environment.
China's U.S. Treasury holdings falling to $651.1 billion, an 18-year low, the lowest since 2008, is one of those structural developments that unfolds slowly but has long-term significance. For decades, the recycling of trade surpluses into U.S. treasuries was a core mechanic of the global financial system. China would sell goods to Americans, take the dollars, and reinvest them in U.S. government debt. That mechanism is clearly weakening. Meanwhile, Japan and the U.K. have been increasing their treasury holdings, which suggests the demand base is shifting rather than collapsing entirely. But the composition of who finances U.S. debt is changing in ways that matter for interest rates and for U.S. fiscal flexibility.
The Besant pressure on Japan to raise rates is a remarkable piece of financial diplomacy. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Besant reportedly pressed Japanese officials to hike rates sooner to avoid larger disruptions later. The Bank of Japan's April minutes confirming internal discussions about rate hikes every few months suggests there's genuine appetite for normalization within the BOJ. Japan has maintained ultra-low interest rates for decades, and the normalization process, if it proceeds, has significant implications for the yen, for Japanese government debt costs, and for the unwinding of the famous carry trade that has been a source of global market instability when it reverses abruptly.
The USDA projection of record production costs for every major crop in 2027 is a story that will compound other economic pressures. The cost drivers are shifting from fuel and fertilizer, which were the 2022 to 2023 story, towards seed, chemicals, labor, and cash rents. That's a structural shift, not a price spike that normalizes when a commodity cools off. Labor and land costs tend to be sticky. When farmers face record costs, they either pass them through in food prices, reduce acreage, or exit the business. All three of those outcomes have downstream effects that reach every grocery store in the country.
The White House analysis on hospital contract clauses deserves a moment here. The estimate that banning anti-competitive hospital insurer agreements could save $45 billion annually and that these agreements inflate premiums for about 24% of employer-insured Americans, is a significant policy claim. This is actually a good moment to explain the underlying legal framework, because the antitrust angle is central to what the White House is proposing. Sherman Act analysis in healthcare markets works differently than in most industries, and understanding why requires a bit of grounding.
Walk us through it, Marcus.
The Sherman Act of 1890, that's the foundational U.S. antitrust statute, prohibits contracts, combinations, or conspiracies that restrain trade, and also prohibits monopolization. The key nuance that trips people up is that monopoly status alone isn't illegal under U.S. law. What's illegal is using monopoly power to harm competition. A company can have 80% market share and not violate the Sherman Act if that share came from genuinely superior products or services. The legal question is always about conduct, not just size. In hospital markets, the conduct at issue involves what are called most favored nation clauses or exclusionary contracting arrangements, where a dominant hospital system uses its leverage to prevent insurers from giving better rates to competing hospitals. The hospital isn't being penalized for being big, it's being penalized for using that size to block competitors. This is distinct from how people colloquially use the word monopoly. It's not about whether one company dominates the market, it's about whether that dominance is maintained through anti-competitive acts. The White House's $45 billion estimate is based on what premiums would look like if these specific contractual arrangements were prohibited.
And Novo Nordisk, shares climbing despite a simultaneous ransomware crisis, is a testament to how powerful the Wegovy narrative has become. Investors are essentially betting that the oral formulation of semaglutide is a large enough market opportunity to overwhelm near-term operational disruption from a cyber attack. That's a fairly aggressive risk calculation, but the GLP-1 market is genuinely that large. Analysts have projected it as a multi-hundred-billion-dollar global opportunity over the next decade.
The World Cup economic projection deserves a mention here, too. $45 billion in global GDP boost, with $19 billion going to the U.S. alone. Bank of America's analysts are comparing it favorably to the Taylor Swift Eras Tour, which generated roughly $5 billion in economic activity. So we're talking about an event with roughly four times that impact in the United States. That's hotel occupancy, restaurant revenue, broadcast rights, merchandise, and tourism infrastructure spending, all materializing over a concentrated period.